You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Today, Ukraine is closer to peace than ever before.
This is called the fog of war. This is what you and the press don't understand.
The president has a right to take them out if they are threatening the United States of America.
Not an easy situation, let me tell you. What a mess.
Listen to the cry of your peoples who are calling for peace.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Nick Ludlam, SBS World News' international editor. And joining me here in Sydney is Katrina Stirrett.
Hi, Nick. I'm expecting a very 10 out of 10 impersonation of Claudia this week.
I'll do my best. I'm standing in again for Claudia, as you've heard, who will be joining us shortly from Aceh province in Sumatra, where the full extent of the destruction from extreme weather is still emerging. And Aaron Fernandez will be joining us from Sri Lanka, which is also reeling from the island's worst weather disaster in recent years.
We'll be dipping into the Ukraine talks, which are currently in Moscow and appear to have hit another wall, as well as a traumatic personal story of asylum seekers in Australia still stuck in limbo over a decade later. Our very own reporter Alex Jones joins us to unpack that story.
And stick with us to the end to find out what a group of escaped Austrian nuns must do to stay in their convent.
Devastating floods and landslides have wreaked havoc across much of South and Southeast Asia in recent days, with over 1,200 people killed across Sri Lanka, Indonesia and Thailand alone.
Hundreds are still missing after tropical storms and heavy rainfall battered the region. On the ground in Aceh province, in Indonesia's northern Sumatra region, is our international correspondent Claudia Farhart. Claudia, thank you so much for joining us. What's the scale of the damage you're seeing in Aceh?
It's pretty devastating, Nick. We're in Pidijaya at the moment, which is about a four-hour drive from Bandar Aceh. It's sort of the start of the disaster zone. And even at this point, we're seeing things like mud right up to people's roofs. Even after a week of trying to clear it, there is just so much mud from these mudslides, the landslides, that people have no idea how long it's going to take to get rid of. Some people think 3 months, 6 months, a year. People are trying to get back to their homes to start cleaning them out at this stage. But to do that, they've got to walk kilometres from where they've set up a few sort of tents for them to sleep in. And that involves them trudging through thick layers of mud. We walked through some of it with them today to reach some of their homes to see what it looked like. It's incredibly difficult. It's like every step requires so much effort just to lift your foot when it's that deep in mud. And that was for us. These people are doing it after a week in what's essentially evacuation centres. They're sleeping in tents, in some cases 50 people to a tent. There's no bedding in them. There's no stable supply of food and water. So they're exhausted, they're hungry, and they're having to do all the physical labour themselves because they say there's still not enough help coming in to help with the cleanup.
Speaking of help, there are reports dozens of communities across Aceh and northern Sumatra are isolated. Are residents in these communities receiving any aid at all?
The government is doing airdrops via helicopters, C-130s, that sort of thing. They came under a lot of pressure to increase those because there were a lot of reports out of those isolated communities that some of them hadn't received any aid at all after 5 or 6 days still. So they do seem to be increasing at the moment. But yeah, we are still hearing that there are some communities that remain completely cut off. There are roads, major roads across the region that are buried in mud, damaged. They've disappeared. And so still the only way to reach some of these communities is by air. The other thing that's been interesting about this, I mean, you know, you cover natural disasters and usually you have a number of people missing and a number of people who've been killed, and one number goes up as the other number goes down. The death toll goes up, the number of people missing goes down. That's not happening this time. Both numbers are going up. The death toll's rising every day by about 100 in Indonesia, and so is the number of people reported missing. And that tells us they still don't really have a grip on just how many people have been impacted by this and how many people might have actually lost their lives in these landslides.
So, Claudia, the destruction sounds pretty extensive. The help is still making its way out. How are people going to rebuild after yet another disaster like this?
I think right now they have absolutely no idea. I mean, some estimates have put the damage toll at something like $4 billion across Indonesia. It's on a huge scale. The governor of Aceh said just the other day that he believes this is the worst natural disaster they've had since the 2004 tsunami. And I mean, that's a pretty big call to make. But coming through the region and seeing it, it does look that widespread. People here are trying to get into their homes and clean them out, but they say the mud is just so high, everything has been so severely damaged that they think they're just going to have to rebuild. But then if you look at the bigger picture, it's not just people's homes, right? We've got major roads linking the entire region that have been damaged. We have the communications network largely down across the region. I mean, if you think about rebuilding an entire communications network, this stuff is going to take a lot of time. The electricity network is down as well. They say here in Aceh, they're planning to have that up and running again by the next week. But what about North Sumatra and West Sumatra? So because of how widespread this is, because of the fact that almost every essential service has been knocked out, it certainly does not look like it's going to be a quick recovery at all for the region.
Thanks so much for making time to join us, Claudia. I know you're heading off further into the destruction zone, so we hope you can stay safe.
Thanks, guys.
Let's bring in international correspondent Aaron Fernandez, who's in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Aaron, similar scenes of devastation where you are. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, good morning. It's a similar scenario to what Claudia just described. I've been walking through and visiting communities in West Colombo that had been devastated by the floods, and a lot of those communities or a lot of those people are coming back to their homes now pretty much for the first time since Cyclone Ditwa hit. Now, walking through those areas, there's still a lot of flood water there. People tell me that they're all pointing to the flood levels, the marks on their homes showing that the floodwaters were 8 feet, 9 feet, 10 feet in height, completely submerging their homes. The floodwaters have receded, but there's still about 4 foot, 5 feet of water that people are having to wade through to reach their properties. And obviously everything that was on the ground level, from everything that their contents, their furniture, any gardens, crops that they might have nearby, all been completely overrun by the floods. And this is an area of Colombo. It's Angoda suburb in West Colombo. It's completely cut off from the main road. And people there say they've received virtually no aid or support, either from volunteers, people in the public just wanting to help, or from government emergency services, just haven't really been able to visit there yet. So, you know, a huge amount of cleanup ahead for these people and these communities before life returns to normal.
So, Aaron, the military's been deployed to help, maybe easier to get to in areas around Colombo. What about further afield? How bad is it?
I have seen a few trucks distributing aid driving through Colombo this morning. There's also emergency services workers out on boats ferrying from one area to the next. It's kind of interesting because there's certain pockets around Colombo that are completely flooded, and it creates these islands. So they've sort of got a hop from one stretch of road to the other, use the boat to ferry in between, and then there's this this pool, this lake of flood water in between. From what we're hearing outside of Colombo, particularly in Central Province and other areas that were hard hit, the conditions of the road are, of course, a factor. There are some communities that it's simply impossible for emergency services to get to at the moment, and there are forecasts of more rain to come, particularly in Central Province over the coming days. So the situation facing those emergency services will probably get worse over the coming days.
And Aaron, what is the government saying? How are they responding to the scale of the disaster?
I mean, Sri Lanka's President Anuradha Dissanayake has called this one of the most significant disasters that the country has faced. Now, Sri Lanka has seen many floods and other natural disasters over the years. It was very severely impacted by the Boxing Day tsunami. But the government is treating this with a high level of seriousness, a state of emergency has been declared. And again, the government is very much recognising that this is one of the most challenging disasters that Sri Lanka has ever faced.
Thanks, Aaron. Really appreciate you being able to update us. And I'm sure we'll be speaking more about this on the pod as the impact of all these extreme weather events will be going on for a long time to come, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Five hours later, and no compromise reached after Russian President Vladimir Putin and the US President's negotiators met to try and iron out remaining sticking points of a revamped US peace proposal for Ukraine, primarily revolving around territorial concessions and security guarantees. The Russian president was joined by US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff in Moscow, as well as Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner. Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov has commented following the long talk, saying peace is no closer but also no further away. So it seems Russia and Ukraine are stuck in what feels like an endless loop of negotiations as Russia remains unwilling to compromise on their ceasefire terms. Many in Kyiv and Europe are suggesting these dragged-out peace talks are all part of Russia's plan to continue its advance on the battlefield in an attempt to wear down Ukraine militarily.
Yes, the original 28-point plan was widely criticised, with many saying it looked like a Russian wish list. After some serious panicking, Ukraine and Europe convinced the more Russia-sceptical US Secretary of State to roll back some of the more outlandish parts, like conceding the rest of the heavily fortified areas of the Donbass, for example, that Russia hasn't been able to capture as yet. Then Ukraine met with US delegates in Florida over the weekend, and while the US says they are very optimistic about what they described as the refined plans, Ukraine remains adamant about ensuring they do not relinquish any more territory to Russia. Details of the new plan are unclear, but we know it has been reduced to 20 points. President Volodymyr Zelensky, on a visit to Dublin, saying he's waiting to hear from the US following the talks in Moscow.
It's a little bit optimism was in my words because of the some speed of negotiations and from American side the interest in it. It shows that America is not withdrawing now from any kind of diplomatic way of dialogue, and it's good. And it's mean that they gave us a signal, so it's about negotiations. If you're ready, we will work.
Prior to the Moscow meeting, Putin lashed out at European leaders who he said were under the illusion they could inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. Here's what he had to say.
We are not planning to fight Europe. I have said this 100 times. But if Europe suddenly decides to wage war against us and starts it, we are ready right now. There can be no doubt about that.
Putin has firmly opposed the revisions to the original plan, which he didn't even concede contained enough Ukrainian concessions for him to agree to it.
Europe has been pushing to provide a bomb-proof security plan, quite literally. Vague notions of the US being paid to intervene if there was an issue, not really filling many with much confidence. And crucially for Europe, they don't want to give Putin a win after invading a sovereign European state.
When we talk about peace, each one of us has a role to play. For Russia, it's to stop the aggression. It has not given any signal, any proof that go into this direction. Ukraine is the only one that can talk about territories. It's about its own territories and sovereignty, recognized by international law.
In the background of all these negotiations is Russia's claims that they have captured the strategically important city of Pokrovsk in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. The Kremlin has proudly boasted of the win, suggesting sceptical journalists can visit the city themselves if they remain doubtful. But Ukraine insists they are still fighting Russian forces there, calling Moscow's claims flag-planting propaganda.
Yes, Putin is also trying to cast the EU as the ones delaying the peace process by insisting on things they know Russia won't agree to. But I'm not sure anyone beyond his own cabal really thinks that's the case. Unfortunately, the worry is Trump and his special envoy, Witkoff, have a tendency to agree with him.
I was a child when all of this happened, and I had no say in how I came here. And I don't know why I'm still being punished.
Really, the problem here is that we have a government policy that was implemented over a decade ago that no longer reflects the practical reality of people's lives.
A group of around 900 asylum seekers who came to Australia by boat nearly 13 years ago and who spent years in offshore detention are protesting still being in visa limbo. Despite living and working in Australia for nearly a decade, they have no pathway to permanent residency thanks to a hardline 2013 immigration policy that means any person that arrived by boat will never be allowed to permanently settle in Australia. They're pleading with the Australian government now to grant them leniency as a last hope.
SBS reporter Alexandra Jones has been digging into this story and spoke to some of the people in this situation, and she joins us now. Alex, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about the people you met and their experiences?
Yeah, so I spoke to two people who are part of this cohort of 900. One you just heard there in the intro, Ferdos. She's 23 years old and she came to Australia by boat when she was just 10 years old and spent 5 years in offshore detention. So 10 to 15, very formative years of her life. But she's now living and working in the community, paying taxes. She's working as an employment specialist, but she and this group cannot ever be permanent residents or citizens. The other person that I spoke to, Sarah Mashalian, she's 42 years old. She came in July 2013, and she's in the same situation, telling me about the traumas that they experienced in offshore detention, also in onshore detention when they were medically evacuated to Australia for periods of time. And they feel like they've suffered enough. They've settled in their communities. They live, they work. She is her legal partner is an Australian citizen. Her brother's an Australian citizen. Her father is an Australian citizen, but she doesn't have any permanent pathway. So these people are kind of now protesting their situation. They think they've tried all of the sort of behind the scenes methods, appealing to, you know, ministers and going through lawyers, but they feel they have no other choice but to kind of go public with their stories and try and appeal for leniency from the immigration minister.
Oh, wow. Sounds pretty devastating. This all stems from this government policy enacted in 2013. What does that actually say, and what does it mean for this particular group of people? I mean, could she potentially be kicked out?
Yeah, so it is a bit confusing, but essentially in July 2013, then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's government came out and said that anyone that arrives by boat from now on will never have a permanent settlement pathway in Australia. And it was only a couple of weeks later that they actually lost the election. The Liberal government came in and they had campaigned on this infamous Stop the Boats campaign, and Operation Sovereign Borders came into effect in September of that year. So, there was just this period of being very strong on borders and having these hardline policies. The two people and this group of 900 came in and around that time, so from sort of July to September. So they kind of have, as we understand it, fallen through the cracks of these policies. They were never granted these sort of certain temporary protection visas, which means that they simply do not have any permanent pathway. They continue to have to renew their visas every 6 months. So the only visa available to them is this bridging visa. They have to renew every 6 months, and they say that it's just incredibly stressful. It takes a real physical and psychological toll. One of the people we spoke to, Sarah, actually said that her mother had a heart attack after she was called by immigration the last time that they called her. So there's just a lot of stress for these people, and they just want to be able to settle permanently and kind of have their visas reflect how they feel, and they feel Australian.
Sounds absolutely traumatising. But didn't the immigration pathways get altered again 2 years ago?
Yes. So funnily enough, people in a very similar situation to this group of 900 that we spoke to, they were offered permanent pathways in early 2023 by then Immigration Minister Andrew Giles. He came out and said that it doesn't make sense for people, former asylum seekers who now work and pay tax and are embedded in their communities, to remain in visa limbo. So what he was saying then really seems to resonate with and apply to what these people are going through. But for some reason, about 900 or so people They arrived after Operation, technically they were in offshore detention at the time of Operation Sovereign Borders. So they weren't in Australia, and they didn't have one of these two specific visas that they needed to be eligible for this 2023 pathway that they opened up.
And obviously these cases remain unresolved, but there's also concern about a new $2.5 billion deal to send more than 350 former detainees currently in Australia to Nauru. What more do you know about this?
Look, it's obviously completely separate from the group that are petitioning to stay in Australia permanently, but we spoke to them about it because we wanted them to, I guess, give their thoughts as people who had spent time on Nauru to see what they thought about, you know, refugees, former asylum seekers being sent back there or being sent there. And look, they told us that they just feel fear that it kind of brings up the same traumas that they experienced. Some of the people that we spoke to spoke of sexual assault. They spoke of horrific living conditions. They spoke even of self-harm, seeing people self-harming. So they're sort of just really struggling with the fact that rather than closing down this offshore detention policy or system, that it's actually being expanded by the Australian government at the same time that they remain in limbo, struggling with the trauma that they experienced over a decade ago on Nauru.
Thank you, Alex, for coming on the pod. Really appreciate it. And if you want to see more of Alex's story, you can go to the SBS website or catch up with it on SBS On Demand.
Time for a quick whip around the globe for a look at some of the other big stories making news. Another week, another round of escalating tensions between the US and Venezuela. Over the weekend, US President Donald Trump declared that the airspace over Venezuela should be considered closed and again suggested possible impending US action on the Venezuelan mainland. Details have also emerged of a November phone call between the leaders of the two nations, wherein Nicolas Maduro declined an ultimatum to give up power immediately, with Trump also turning down the Venezuelan president's counter-demands.
Also this week, the White House confirmed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth authorized multiple strikes on an alleged Venezuelan drug boat which killed 11 people in September. Trump has defended Hegseth amid reports he ordered the second strike with the words, "kill everybody," knowing there were survivors in the water. The so-called double-tap strikes have drawn bipartisan criticism in the US, with both Republican and Democratic lawmakers calling for a congressional review into US strikes on vessels allegedly carrying drugs. Even the Pope has weighed in, exhorting President Trump not to take military action on Venezuela and instead talk it out. He's been touring Turkey and now just finished a tour of 4 days in Lebanon, where he's been trying to get all sides there to speak to each other after long years of division, which are ongoing.
Hong Kong's leader John Lee says he's ordered an independent inquiry into last week's deadly apartment blaze, which burned seven high-rise buildings and claimed well over 100 lives. The judge-led committee will conduct a review of the city's building practices after an initial report found that substandard netting around the high-rise buildings likely accelerated the fire.
Police have now arrested at least 15 people on suspicion of manslaughter, including the directors of a construction company. But there are also concerns about a crackdown on criticism, with at least two people under investigation for sedition. A 24-year-old student, Miles Kwan, was detained and later released after handing out flyers demanding government accountability over the fire.
Donald Trump has escalated his crackdown on immigration, announcing a, quote, permanent pause on migration from all third world countries. He had already announced visa bans on 12 countries and is now saying migrants must be capable of loving the US and be a net asset to the country. Not quite clear how those criteria would be judged.
Yeah, tricky one that. Seems a fairly subjective suggestion. The changes come in the wake of last week's shooting of two National Guard members in Washington, D.C., one of whom later died, after the suspect was identified as an Afghan national. Critics of the measures say they amount to collective punishment. He did say, however, that white South Africans would be excluded from the ban, even though claims of their persecution have been widely discredited as false.
Früher in Deckung gehen.
Genau. Nein, jetzt ist es trotzdem schon. Da und jetzt habe ich.
So it's not the first time we've spoken about these mischievous sisters. Believe it or not, what you're hearing there is 82-year-old Sister Rita breaking into laughter during a boxing lesson at her convent near Salzburg, Austria. Now, it's just weeks after the nun and her two partners in crime, Sister Regina and Sister Bernadette, staged an incredible escape from their care home back to their convent, parishioners and a local locksmith aiding their mission. The three say they were brought to the home against their will after the local abbey and Archdiocese of Salzburg acquired the convent.
Yeah, Sister Rita says they're being called the Rebellious Sisters, much to their amusement. Not only because of their theatrical escape, but because they are now refusing to give up their social media. It's one of the conditions spelt out in their superior provost Marcus Grassel's offer to allow the nuns to stay at the convent.
Imagine what the young Australian teenage influencers could do to overturn the social media ban here with the backing of these three icons. The sisters made their appeal via a social media video saying they cannot agree to the deal because without social media they would be silenced. They added any agreement must be reached in accordance with God's will. So really pleading to the boss upstairs over this one.
Dem stehe ich ganz locker gegenüber.
So Sister Rita is saying there that she's quite relaxed about the demands on them to quit social media, laughing while saying, quote, they can't shut us up. That's how I would put it.
And support for the trio is clear. They have a growing community of some 185,000 followers. Probably a lot more than that after this podcast, I would say, Kat. They might be calling themselves the octogenarian squatters, but they're clearly savvy when it comes to Instagram.
Yep, their pushback is having an influence. The provost's spokesperson now diverting the issue over to the Vatican to solve. Don't mess with the sisters.
Blimey.
And will Trump win the next best thing to a Nobel Peace Prize? Rumours FIFA is bestowing the US president its highest non-athletic honour. Tune in next week to find out.
And that's The World This Week. If you're enjoying the podcast, be sure to like and subscribe. New episodes will drop every Thursday.
Thanks for doing your best impersonation of Claudia this week, Nick.
You're welcome.
And as always, thanks to our producers, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dallenberg.